Thank you so much. Sorry, I've just lost my place. I was saying there's just one more aspect before we move to the judgment. So in the report, we find a copy of the alleged contract between Mr. Andile Ramaphosa and Busasa. We won't go into that. And then summary of the evidence of the late Mr. Watson. But I want to just take you to 5.3.10.61. Right. Okay. Just we won't go this a diagram, but I'm just going to take you through some of the information which you found. At 5.2.10.61, do you remember this part where it said, from the evidence received by my office, that means you and the public protector, I can confirm that the 500,000 payment was transferred from Mr. Watson's personal account as part of a lump sum of 2 million rand account into Miyota Trading, eventually EFG2 trust account, which is an attorney's trust account for the CR17 campaign. You remember that part?
Yes, I do, I remember.
And the same... And the next one I won't read is also to the same effect. It's about large sums of money or whatever. And then 5.3.10.63, and this was the type of amounts we were dealing with here. So it said, from the evidence received by my office, an amount of 191,482,227.43 was deposited in the EFG2 APSA account on 6 December 2016 and 2018, and 190 million was transferred out of this account in the same period. So this would have been over a period of about a year, correct?
It is correct.
And that's the example of what I was saying about. It's almost, if you do accounting, it's almost like debit and credit. So you had evidence of the money coming in, and then obviously the journey of the money over that period until the money is finished, quote unquote, at a particular point, correct?
That is correct.
The same, okay, I'll just take a random figure. The next one was 388 million, and then the same 388 by a number of rands and cents was transferred out of in the same period, correct?
Yes, correct.
The next one is 441 million until February 2019, correct?
Yes, correct.
And the other one is 335 million, and the last one is 51 million or so. So, and all the trackings of those amounts was the same as you and I have described before, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Then we moved to, I was looking for another transaction, but we'll deal with that tomorrow or we won't deal with it. But I'm just dealing with types of transactions so that I don't deal with all of them individually. But I can't find it now on my pages here. But do you remember there was also reference to some amount which was seemingly solicited from outside of the country? I'm not sure if it was the US or the UK by Mr. Godan, which also ended up in this CR17 campaign, correct?
No, I don't recall that one.
Okay, yes. No, that's fine. It's probably in the judgment, but we will it had to do with something which was once called a fake intelligence report. That's fine. But anyway, I think we get the picture. Now, the matter then went, or rather, the report, your report was issued. This part every South African knows. The report was issued, the Busasa CR17 report, and then President Ramaphosa took the matter to the High Court in Johannesburg. Where three judges sat, and what we lawyers call a full court, chaired by the Judge President Mlambo, and he reviewed your report, and the court found in his favor. I'm just cutting a long story short. Correct?
That is correct.
And being the chief investigator, you would have been privy, or were you privy to the pleadings, in other words, the papers that were filed on behalf or by Mr. Ramaphosa?
I was aware of it. Our legal services.
Yes. And again, just to save time, I won't go through the gory details of the actual affidavit, but I just want to establish one fact, which is important for the committee, which is that the gist of Mr. Ramaphosa's accusations against the public protector were that all this was just a figment of the public protector's imagination, or yours by extension, and that it was your report was not really based on the evidence that you have just shared with us, but was based on some vendetta and political witch hunt. You might not have used those words, but it was that it was not a genuine outcome, correct?
It is correct.
And that is what the only important thing for the purposes of this committee. In other words, that which the judges confirmed and that which Ms. Natasha Mazzoni later used as part of her motion for us to be here today, the origins of those allegations of bias or political motives or whatever was Mr. Ramaphosa himself in his founding papers, correct?
It is correct.
Yeah. And yes, and so like the money, it doesn't matter how many times it travels from the donor to the recipient, but the original source of the allegations that they've brought us here is, I think this was confirmed by Ms. Mviana as well yesterday, in each case would be the applicant, the person who actually brought that matter to the court. We can't blame the court for it, as it were. You would know that as a lawyer, correct?
That is correct.
Yes. Okay. Well, I want, we tried to impress that on the committee so that we get the source of the allegations that have brought us here. But we were told that that source is quote unquote irrelevant. But there you are. Now, and then of course, just for the sake of completion, the public protector would have then put a respondent answering affidavit with input from you and others who participated in this, obviously refuting those claims of bias and political motive and all sorts of things, correct?
That is correct.
And there was another affidavit by a Mr. Julius Silomalema, who supported the coming from the party that was part of the complaint, who also participated in that litigation, correct? To your knowledge?
That is correct. Yes, it is correct.
Right. Okay, so that sets the scene. I won't go into those affidavits in detail, Chair. They are before the committee. So I'm jumping now from the report to those affidavits and then the judgments. Just to save time. Sorry, let me just check how we're doing for your time. Okay. All right, we'll try and release you even before that time, because I was told that you have some engagement. Right, so let's then go into the judgment quickly. Again, for the sake of time, I won't go into much detail on the, as far as the first judgment is concerned. That's safe to say that the judgment found, among other things, that the report must be set aside because just looking for an expression that will characterize the kind of sentiment. The judge said, counsel for the president submitted that conduct of patrons in this case shows a, quote, a reckless determination to make an adverse finding against the president. So that is what the president accused you of doing, you and the public protector. A reckless determination to make adverse findings against him personally, correct?
Yes, and it's unfortunate, I can say.
Yes, no, sorry, I know it must be hurtful. I did ask Ms. Mviana yesterday how such statements make you feel after all the blood and sweat, but we'll deal with that. At another stage, let's try and be strong for now. and put the feelings aside. And on the basis of that, of those kinds of comments, and there are many of them, it was said, these conclusions of yours were reached irrationally and recklessly, and without an open mind. And the like, and that for that reason the public protector not only should the report be set aside, but that she should be directed to pay the president's cost on an attorney and client scale, in other words on a punitive scale for daring to trouble him like this, correct?
That is correct.
And so that's then that outcome, which I've paraphrased, which then becomes the platform for Ms. Mazzoni and her fellow travelers to bring us here, correct?
That is correct.
But then the matter went to the Constitutional Court. The public protector appealed those findings, and some of them, which are worse than what I have just said, directly to the Constitutional Court. You remember that?
I do remember, yes.
Okay, and again, I won't take you through the pleadings of each side, but anyone would now be able to work out the public protector was saying those findings are wrong, and the president was saying, no, those findings are correct, and they are warranted. She is indeed, you and her and other people were determined to get him for political, well, let me not put words in the mouth of the president. I think it was Mr. Gordhan who claimed specifically political motives and corrupt, and state capture and all those things. You remember the allegations made in the Pillay and so-called rogue unit allegations, that actually what motivated you is that you were part of the state capture gang and corruption mongers, correct?
Yes, I do remember, yes.
Okay, fine, we'll deal with those separately. Yes, the president said you have ulterior motives, but I'm not quite sure if he explained, unlike Mr. Gordhan, what those ulterior motives were. Fine. Then, when we get to the Concord judgment, this is how I want to approach it in the period that is remaining. Effectively, you would be aware that Concord, on the part of the public protector at least, the Chief Justice Mogoeng found that judgment of the High Court was baseless and had to be rejected for various reasons, which I'll go into now. But the majority judgment agreed with the High Court. You are aware of that, correct?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Thanks. And needless to say, I asked one of the witnesses, but just for the record, of those two judgments, you agree with the judgment of Mogoeng Chief Justice, correct?
Okay. Yes.
Thanks, yes. No, that's what I was saying, at the risk of stating the obvious, because he actually, and this is important for the purposes of this committee, because if your findings were so outrageous as Ms. Mazzoni would like us to believe, then the someone no less than the Chief Justice would not have agreed that you and I know this was a minority judgment, so but the point I'm making is that no less than the Chief Justice agreed that yours was a good effort, and that your findings had good grounds. I know you were saying that the other remarks were hurtful, but I hope the fact that the Chief Justice of the country found that you were justified made you feel slightly better, correct?
That is correct.
Yes. Now, that goes to the gist, really, because this goes to both to this matter and the CX matter. Because in the CX matter, actually, it was not only Chief Justice Mogoeng, it was also Justice Goliath. There were two judges who had a dissenting judgment, but that you were not involved in CX, correct?
It is correct, I wasn't.
Yes. But I think the same logic holds that, well, at least to your knowledge, was Chief Justice Mogoeng impeached for agreeing with your report?
No, he wasn't.
And I'll just very quickly, okay, to be fair, let me start with the parts that are against you. I'm just taking random passages. The one of the key issues, before I go to those passages, also just to paraphrase, one of the key issues that arose in this matter was whether the public protector had jurisdiction, because this matter concerned quote unquote private political party funding, and that issue went, legally speaking, went to the issue of whether the president had personally benefited, which is what the relevant quote says, personally benefited from those donations made to the CR17 campaign. You confirm that?
Yes, I do.
And the other issue, which where you were lambasted by the earlier court and this court, was the reference that was made by the public protector to the 2007 version of the Code of Ethics, where she was accused of having amended that code because the applicable one was the 2000 code. So in other words, you and her had once again deliberately went to amend the Code of Ethics. You remember that one?
I do remember.
And I'm sure you found that even more hurtful, because that suggested like manipulation and I don't know what on your part, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. So this is then what the majority said at paragraph 72. Sorry, I don't know if you have that judgment. Okay, good. Can you then go to paragraph 72? No, sorry. I start at 59. I'll start with the hurtful part so that we get it out of the way. Okay, then here, yeah, this is what the judges say. But what is more concerning with the report is that the public protector changed the wording of the code by adding, quote, deliberate and inadvertent misleading of the legislature. In other words, you and the public protector went to add words in the code which were not existent. But the truth is that those were the words that were used in the 2007 version that you had employed, correct?
Yes, from the handbook, it's correct.
It's actually from the ministerial handbook, yes. It's not so that you manufactured these words and changed the code, correct?
That is correct.
And when the when the public protector leaves her evidence, I don't want to bore you with the ins and outs of this code because we will attach it to her statement. And with your experience as well, can you confirm at least one factor, which is one of the issues we would have raised with Advocate Madonsela, because she is involved in this, that the code that you had used is the very same code that she, Advocate Madonsela, had used in the famous EFF Nkandla case, in respect of which President Ramaphosa's predecessor, was condemned. You remember that?
It is correct. Yes, it is correct. It is like that. And
yes.
Then when we were finalizing our report, that we even had sight of the Nkandla report, which has the very words. Yes.
Yes. So if you have deliberately added those words, then it would also mean Advocate Madonsela did the same to nail, quote-unquote, President Zuma, correct?
It would look like that, yes.
Yes, but, well, we know the truth is that neither she nor you had actually deliberately used the wrong code. It is because that was the code that had been used by everyone until the legality of the other one was established, correct?
That is correct.
Right. And now, a person in your position who is a servant of the people or in the position of a public protector and the former public protector for that matter, can you be justifiably faulted for using, rightly or wrongly, a version of the executive code which had had the endorsement of the Constitutional Court in the Nkandla judgment? Is it fair to do so?
It's not fair, especially when one does the bona fides behind, you know, the whole investigation and the report that we issued.
Absolutely, thank you. That is the point really, isn't it? It doesn't matter, let's say you got the law wrong or you looked at the wrong law. So even us as lawyers, sometimes you read an act and you quote it only to find out from further research that it was repealed 2 years later. So the point is not that. The point is whether in doing so, as you say, you were, let's assume you used the wrong code, whether in doing so you are motivated by bona fide mistake, or whether you were out to pursue the alleged conspiracy. And I think it's the second part that you are offended by, isn't it? Because you don't suggest that you are superhuman, you don't make mistakes. Right. Then we can go to paragraph 70. I think that, yeah, well, someone is having a party. Okay, in a nutshell, again, I'll avoid reading for the sake of... In a nutshell, then, the majority also agreed that the president did not receive personal benefit, I suppose, even though he became the president of the ANC and the president of the country, somehow he did not benefit personally. That's what the court found, correct?
I'd rather not comment on this, Wenpoho.
No, okay, no. I'm not attributing it to you. I'm saying that's what the court found, correct?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Okay, well, this one, just so that it's clear, you know, we're not attributing it to you. I'll just read it as it is in the judgment, because otherwise I'm sure you would also not want to be much associated with it. But in paragraph 91, it says, quote, in our multi-party system, being the president of a political party, apparently such as the ANC, is not a guarantee to being president of the country. That was one of the findings of the court, correct?
That is correct.
Right, okay. So, as I said, I was doing that for the sake of fairness, so that we start with the bad news, for you at least. Now, the Chief Justice, Mogoeng, and I think this is one of his last judgments, and unfortunately, he is lost to the system now, but some of these judgments, you know, they say that these judgments, the minority judgments, you've heard this, I'm sure, as a lawyer, that today's minority judgments are tomorrow's leading judgments, correct? In other words, yes. You know, there was a famous Judge Schreiner who fought the apartheid bench valiantly and alone in the 60s and 70s. And all his minority judgments, he just dissented knowing that he was never going to win against those apparatchiks. But all his judgments have now become the basis of some of our most progressive judgments. So you'd be familiar with that history from constitutional law, correct?
It is correct.
Right. So this is what Justice Mogoeng says, and I think it's important for me to go through this. Oh, at least there's still a bit of time, yeah, if you forgive me. Because for some reason, when these judgments are reported, firstly, we never even get told that there is a powerful dissent. But even worse, you'll never see any medium in South Africa even covering what that contrary view, which is not the same as the head mentality, says. So I want to, both for you and for the members of the public who are not aware, but also just to put perspective on the Mazoni motion, which is that your report was an outrage. I will quote some of the conclusions reached by Justice Mogoeng, and I'm sure you've read this, so you'll confirm those that you remember, and or make your own comment, please. Can you do that?
We'll do it, Wendo.
Thank you very much, Mr. Matabog. At paragraph 158, Tsepo. Let's start at 150. Just for context. He says, I read the main judgment, that's not bad news for you, sorry. Just go a little bit up, simple, just for context. So, further up. That is the order then of the majority judgment which was against you. Leave to appeal is granted. The appeal is dismissed. The matter is referred to. Okay, that's another case. And no order to cause in respect of the parties. So at least there was some good news for you there. In the sense that the Constitutional Court did not agree that you needed to be punished. So I hope you'll take that as something positive from the majority, correct? Are you still with us, Mr. Matabog?
That is correct. I was saying, as well as, I think, paragraph 3 there, relating to Amabungani.
Oh yes, paragraph 3, sorry I jumped that, yes, for perspective, let me read it. So the dismissal of Amabungane's claim for constitutional invalidity of executive X code was certified, yeah. Yes, that was positive, but also paragraph 6, where the no orders to cost was ordered, correct?
It is correct.
Yeah. So in other words, the only punitive cost order that remained was the High Court one. Meaning the public protector's office, at least we didn't have to pay the cost for the Constitutional Court part. Okay. But okay, fine, then let's go to the good news. 150, that's the one further down, yeah. So Justice Mogoeng then said, against that background, I read the main judgment written by my brother, Chapter J, with great interest, and thankfully relied on the facts set out in it. Subject to contextual modulation, context being everything. And then he said, sadly, we part ways on the approach, the reasoning, and the outcome, save where the contents otherwise indicate. And he then says, this case is fundamentally about at least two foundational values of our democratic state. Transparency or openness and accountability. It is also about how dangerous to governance apparently philanthropic gestures or sponsorship could be if the teeth of our integrity, transparency, accountability, enforcement mechanism are not allowed to checkmatingly bite with potential insidious practices. Let's then jump to paragraph 158. The rest is he's quoting the Ethics Act and all that. Yeah. Thank you. I'm very sorry, sir. We can go to 155. Because this then places the public protector's involvement in this. The Chief Justice says the following. Central to the complaint was therefore money that was paid to the CF17 campaign, undeniably intended to strengthen the president's prospects of becoming what he eventually became. How the public protector got to investigate the CF17 campaign does not seem to be a consequence of some inexplicable fishing expedition or of being unduly or overly suspicious of the president. Honorable Maimane asked her to look into a potentially compromising donation to the president, which, as stated, we now know was to the CF17 campaign, and alluded, albeit not in so many words, to a possible conflict between the president's official responsibilities and his private interests by mentioning the billions of rands received by African globe corporations in irregular state tenders. Then he turns to the facts. We'll jump that in the law. You remember that part?
I do, Arvin Bohu.
Yes. Then he says at 158, when a vacancy in the presidency of the governing party, and by extension the presidency of the republic, loomed large, the then deputy president, His Excellency Cyril Ramaphosa, decided to raise his hand. Apparently, a successful campaign for the attainment of that personal ambition or private interest required financial resources in abundance. And the funding mechanism for that race to the top was developed with his blessings. I say with his blessing advisedly because he too contributed his own money to the kitty. He reportedly addressed fundraising meetings attended by sponsors and he interacted with some of the sponsors. He does not seem to have been oblivious to the existence and purpose of the CR17 campaign. You remember that?
I do, Arvin Bohu.
Right. And we now know the Section 96C of the Constitution, which says that members of the cabinet must not expose themselves to a situation involving the risk of a conflict. A mere risk is enough. He says at 162, when people or entities other than the then deputy president's party gave him sponsorship or financial assistance for the purposes of realizing his ultimate political dream, he was, by accepting help or allowing others to accept help on his behalf, exposing himself to a situation involving the risk of conflict. You are familiar with the Section 96, correct?
I am correct.
Then let's jump to 163. And this was a response to the allegation that the president was insulated from knowing the donors. And I think this is the most profound point made by Chief Justice Mokgweng, which is that even if you accept that the president was insulated from knowing the donors were not insulated from knowing him. And those would have been the corrupt ones. And then he says at 163, when the then deputy president urged and allowed potential donors to sponsor his own ambition to become president of his party, he was thereby exposing himself to a situation that is an incubator of a risk of conflict. Donors knew who they were helping, and if the unethical ones, assuming there are any among them, were ever to desire help or favors from the state, they would know who to go to. The deputy president and soon to be president. There is an ever-abiding risk of conflict between being financed to become president of a party, a private interest, and one's position as the deputy president and leader of government, business in parliament, or president of the republic, the official responsibility. it is necessary to emphasize that there is nothing to suggest that the sponsors were somehow interdicted or legally forbidden from informing the real beneficiary of the extent of their individual contributions and even producing proof. You remember that part?
Yes, I do.
And we jump paragraph 164. At 165, the Chief Justice then says, it is the Deputy President who, as a matter of private interest, not only wanted to become the President of the ANC, but self-evidently also desired and planned to be the President of the Republic. It requires a hair-splitting exercise to seek to draw a line between the pursuit of the presidency of the ANC and the desire to rise to the highest office of president of our country. Similarly, it would require unprecedented linguistic gymnastics to seek to draw a line between channeling funds through the CR17 campaign fund to fund the race or campaign to the top and the personal benefit to be derived by the one desirous of the resultant elevation. Do you remember that part?
Yes, I do.
And then we jump the first part of 166. The Chief Justice says, excusing disclosure as a result of the juristic veneer of the likes of the CR17 campaign or its trust account is a sure way of enabling wrongdoing, corruption, or even so-called state capture. And he says, ascension to raw power or the Supreme Office enabled by funding sourced by the CR17 campaign was a quintessential personal benefit and a personal achievement or success. Remember that part?
Yes, I do.
Then let's jump to 169. Or 168. For this reason, oh, 167. I'll just send it one sentence. That trust or entity was in reality of the CR17 campaign. In reality, a proverbial middleman between the financial sponsorship or assistance and Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa. And then at 168, he says, he lists many things that he did. For this reason, whatever legal personality the president and his campaign managers may have chosen to clothe the repository of his campaign sponsorship or financial assistance with cannot detract from the naked truth that, one, he pleaded with potential sponsors to give money in and for his name, CR17. And then he says in brackets, explain what CR17 means. Cyril Ramaphosa's campaign for the ANC presidency in 2017, close bracket. Then he says, he knew that the money that he was being given and spent on his own ambitious campaign came from an agreed structure known as CR17 campaign, to which he also contributed. And three, he personally benefited from the sponsorship that propelled his campaign to its logical conclusion, the presidency of the ANC. Election or elevation to a position you desire is a benefit. And the benefit is personal because the targeted beneficiary gets to occupy and enjoy the position and all its accompaniments. It is perhaps necessary to state the obvious. The position is not occupied by a group, but by an individual. When the sponsored one attains the desired position, people congratulate him or her, because they see him or her as the winner, the successful one. And then at paragraph 169, it says, the foundational values of openness and accountability demand that we pierce through the trust veil that is capable of inadvertently or by design translating the all-important disclosure in this corruption-infested country. Why would anybody not want to know who is helping them? And how reasonable, practicable is that anyway? And why would they want to have their benefactors unknown to Parliament or the public best that the refusal to know in circumstances where one is under the duty to know and the consequential failure to disclose is a sure, albeit unintended, recipe for corruption under the cover of facilitation of a well-structured mechanism or legal stratagem, again not intended, but having the inescapable effect of evading accountability, openness, and disclosure. I'm sure you remember the part that deals with the code as well. Can we then jump to paragraph 173, Mr. Matabuha?
Correct. Can you jump to 173?
Thank you. The Chief Justice then says, referring to the emails, as a matter of practice and law, the contents of an email or a document by X and Y, or sorry, let me just preface this for the benefit of the members. This was in apropos the issue of where did the public protector get these emails and all that, and whether they have been authenticated. And then he says that, as a matter of practice and law, the contents of an email or a document by X and Y may, assuming its authenticity is not disputed, be used to contradict and discredit their own oral evidence and vice versa. This extends to the evidence of a recipient of those emails who might have asserted a contrary view. He or she may be similarly discredited. For this reason, the public protector ought to be understood to be saying that the oral evidence of the president and the CR17 campaign managers regarding what the happenings in the campaign with regard to the donors and their donations was effectively belied by their own exchange of emails that revealed that the president knew what they claimed in their oral evidence that he did not know. You remember that part, Mr. Matabuha?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. But then it says about the code at 177. More importantly, as the public protector correctly found, so this is a part that vindicates your report, Mr. Atabov. More importantly, as the public protector found, when he received or caused others to receive the sponsorship or financial benefit, he was still Deputy President of the Republic and a Member of Parliament. The code applied to him fully. He cannot be exempted from the consequences of what he did then by reason only of the fact that the code personal benefit has worked so well that he now occupies the position of president in line with his and the sponsor's set objectives. Then I'm going to the last three or so. At paragraph 180, says in favor of the public protector, 179, sorry. The Audi Alteram Partem rule is an integral part of a fair trial process and a fundamental element of justice. How it applies to the public protector must be guided by how it ordinarily applies to court proceedings, civil and criminal. This is in relation to something that was raised in a question by Honorable Sukas to Mr. Viana yesterday about the learnings that are gained from this judgment. And I referred her to this issue of the double Audi. You are familiar with it, Section 79 of the Public Protector Act, Mr. Matabuha.
Correct, maybe?
Yes. The Chief Justice agreed with your approach. He says, I disagree with the views to the effect that the Audi Alteram principle obliges the public protector to inform a party likely to be adversely affected by the remedial action of the remedial action she is minded to take. In civil litigation, judges and magistrates are never under any Audi-induced obligation to inform the parties of the remedy they are mostly likely to give. Sometimes they do make their preliminary views on remedy known to the parties and solicit their views. But this is never done as a result of some legal obligation whose failure to fulfill could result in an injustice or unfairness which could or would then give rise to the need to vitiate the decision in order or the order of the court. Not even in a criminal case is a court requires by the Audi principle to indicate in advance what sentence it is likely to impose. Justice would be sufficiently served by affording all parties the opportunity to deal with the sentence that may be imposed, regard being heard to the fact of the case and what the accused person would have been convicted of. And then he says, the test cannot be any higher when it comes to the public protector, who does not even have the authority to impose terms of imprisonment on those she investigates. She is therefore only required to have the parties deal with what they consider to be a possible, but not necessarily pre-announced, remedial action event of the complaints under investigation being established. Although not precluded to give a hint at her preliminary views on the remedial action, she is not legally obligated to do so. And Section 7(9) of the Public Protectors Act, which really is a codification of the Audi principle, must be understood in this context. I'm sure you would agree, Mr. Matabofe?
Yes, I'm agreeing 100%.
Yes.
And, because even on the 7(9) that we issue, the request for extensions and so forth, and we engage further on whatever they need to submit.
Yes, and is it correct, okay, that when you do, in fact, this is another issue we would have raised with Advocate Matontela, and I might take advantage of your experience. It's true that during the era of Advocate Matontela, the Section 7(9) reports were called provisional reports, correct?
That is correct.
I'm sorry, Section 7(9) letters, which are now issued in the Mkhwebane era, were called provisional reports in the Matontela era, correct?
That is correct, Mr.
Yes, and I think that's very important because, again, in this committee, in terms of both in the CX and FREDE matters, there is some confusion because it is said that the public protector of the Mkhwebane in one case, I mixed them up myself. I think in CX, in CX it is said that she broadened the scope of the investigation as compared to the provisional report. I mean, that just doesn't make sense because the provisional report is one thing and then the actual investigation is another. But in the Freer the Dairy matter, she's accused of the opposite. Here now, she narrowed the scope of the investigation required by the complaint, I'm reading from the charge, as commenced by her predecessor Advocate Matontela, who is said to be irrelevant, without providing any rational or proper explanation. That's what is said. And then at 4.4, it is also said that Advocate Mkhwebane materially altered the remedial action proposed in the provisional report prepared by her predecessor, Advocate Matontela, before issuing the final report without providing any rational or proper explanation. And I just wanted you to assist the members by explaining that what was known as provisional report is the same thing as a Section 7(9) letter, correct?
It is correct.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we have only about 20, 30 minutes. Okay. Then paragraph 182 says the Chief Justice. Edit 182, please, Chapa. Had it not been for the whistleblower who shared emails with the public protector, it would most likely have never been known that the president and his campaign team presented facts known to be incorrect to the public protector. And with regard to these emails, which enjoyed some attention in the preceding paragraphs, it is necessary to do a recap on the relevant background. The president and the CR17 team chose to and represented to the public protector that he deliberately kept himself and was intentionally and strategically kept ignorant of the donors and the extent of their contributions to the campaign, as well as operations of the campaign in relation to those financial contributors. The public protector subsequently got hold of and relied on emails that belie the president and the CR17 campaign manager's shared version of the president's professed ignorance. What follows is what the president and the public protector said in their affidavits. Then they say what the public protector said. Where they said the public protector could not possibly have arrived at rational conclusions, blah, 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 all those things. They quoted from the public protector's answering affidavit, which is part of the material evidence presented by advocate by Ms. Mazzoni to this committee. And the Honorable Chief Justice then quotes that paragraph of the public protector, which is the version she will give to this committee when she gives evidence. Paragraph 183. After all these accusations by the president, although I'm not going to read it out, just to link it to the alleged irrelevance of the president to this process, the Justice Mokgweng quotes the president himself at paragraphs at 182, 1311, 1312, 38, 39, 40, 87, 88, 89, and 90 of the president. And then this is the response of the public protector. She says, it is telling that instead of the contents of the email, or rather, it is telling that instead of denying the contents of the email, the president complains about how I obtained the emails to which I refer. I receive many documents from anonymous whistleblowers. These emails were provided to my office anonymously and in hard copies. It is for that reason that I have no metadata in respect thereof. However, even if I knew the identities of the whistleblowers, and this is again another issue we raised yesterday, yeah, and the Chief Justice underlines this for emphasis. However, even if I knew the identities of the whistleblowers, I have an obligation to protect them. What the president has to do is to take this honorable court and the country at large into his confidence and explain the contents of these emails. I deny that I obtained the emails unlawfully. Just can you assist us as to how much in your experience as an investigator you rely on whistleblowers and what your obligation is to protect their identities?
I'd say it's almost a daily occurrence, because if one were to check our files, most of our files are even titled anonymous, whereas we know who the whistleblower would be. But we receive them, I wouldn't say, you know, how many times, but they are a common occurrence.
Yes. Thank you. And how seriously do you take your duty to protect those people? In other words, if the president says, well, you have these emails that show that the money went here and went here and went there, instead of saying, no, I don't know anything about such money, says, how did you get that information? Would you reveal to a person like him or any other implicated person the source?
No, we wouldn't. In fact, we have been on many occasions been told to bring the source for cross-examination or for questioning in some of the interviews that we have with the respondents, and they don't want to engage with the anonymous complainant, and we've never allowed it.
Yes. And isn't that one of the essential, again, fallacies that people who don't know the type of work that you do will equate the type of evidence you deal with that of a court? I can tell you now, a court would never even look at evidence that if it cannot say, except in extremely exceptional circumstances, if it cannot say where that evidence came from, that it meets the rules of evidence and so on. But in your type of investigation and inquisitorial process, that is not the case. You are entitled to rely on evidence that is would in a court of law be rejected, correct?
That is correct.
Right. Then that issue we will deal with when the PP testifies, because that's another problem that is completely misunderstood. Then it says we're coming towards the end of this. Okay, I'll read two paragraphs to save time. 187.
Are there people going out and in of your space, Mr. Matabuke, or is the staff members leaving? What is happening?
So you hear it, but then they are trying to force my door open. They want to say goodbye to me. So I've locked myself in.
Okay.
Sorry, Mr. Matabuke. Okay, we're going to release you soon. So hopefully you're not locked in there for too long. All right. 187 and 188, I think it's almost the cracks of what the Honorable Chief Justice says. At 187, he says about this issue of anonymous emails. The President says repeatedly that he was not afforded the opportunity to be heard before the emails were finally relied on, that they were stolen or irregularly obtained from the CR17 campaign computers and because they constitute improperly obtained evidence, that irregularity alone is sufficient to vitiate the entire report. Well, unfortunately here, that means he confirmed that they were stolen, quote unquote, from the CR17 campaign computers. Is that what you understood by that part?
Yes, this is how I understand it.
Yeah. And then it says, the President effectively acknowledges the existence and admits the authenticity of the emails, which is, he confirms that there are indeed communications between him and, among others, the CR17 campaign team contained in the computers of the CR17 campaign. He demands more than once that the public protector should explain to him how and from whom she obtained this admittedly truthful but reputationally damaging emails. Not once does he explain why he and his team chose not to tell the truth, but to rather mislead the public protector as they did. Instead, he says that the emails are, in any event, irrelevant to the public protector's findings. But that cannot be correct, for not only are the emails relevant, but they also expose the falsehood of the version that the President and the CR17 campaign manager chose to present to the public protector. You remember that?
I do, Arwindo.
And then then the cracks at 188, he says, and it bears repetition that the false version is that there was a deliberate plan to ensure that the president does not get to know who the donors were, how much they were donated, and how the financial assistance received for his campaign was being used. The emails squarely belie this assertion. The question we would then be asking ourselves is, quote, he says, why did the president and his team deliberately convey a falsehood on an issue so crucial and inextricably connected to the constitutional imperative to promote and observe the high ethical standards in obedience to the demands of our democratic state's founding values, openness and accountability? He must have known that if the truth evidenced by the emails were to be told, the obligation to disclose the names of the funders and the size of their contributions to the National Assembly and by extension to the public would automatically and plainly be triggered. Okay, thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Titi. This one, paragraph 190, he then says, truth or integrity is, after all, at the heart of the office of the President of the Republic, particularly in relation to his or her constitutional obligation. Deciding to present a version known to be untrue as an organ of state whose constitutional duty it is to strengthen our democracy is conduct that is inconsistent with that high office and the obligations that the incumbent has to uphold, defend, and respect the Constitution. And so is the failure to report the sponsorship of financial assistance from donors that he has addressed and asked to donate to the CR17 campaign. Then this part, number 191, lest we forget, we are not dealing here with an average citizen, but with the bearer of specific and frighteningly weighty constitutional responsibilities, including the suspension and non-suspension of the public protector who was investigating him. Sorry, that's part I'm adding myself here. But the Chief Justice said, who is expected and required to lead by example and be above reproach. His office demands of him to be the lighthouse, the pathfinder, the embodiment of and vessel for the enforcement of high ethical standards, particularly the foundational values of our democratic state. In this instance, transparency, accountability, and the supremacy of the Constitution. Like all of us, he has rights. But unlike all of us, he does have special obligations not imposed by court, but by the Constitution and legislation. It is the President, the number one or first citizen of the Republic, who we are talking about here. His is a distinctive and supreme office in the land that does not permit the employment of extraordinary technicalities when issues of ethics, transparency, accountability, upholding and respecting the Constitution has to be considered and pronounced upon. It is in this context that one is constrained to keep on saying that technicalities must not be allowed to easily frustrate the fulfillment of the core constitutional obligations and the attainment of substantive justice. You remember that portion, Mr. Matabuka?
Yes, I do, Edwin Poe.
And then he says towards the end, and this is an important part for you and your findings that we went through earlier. 192, thank you. The Chief Justice says, it bears repetition that the president carefully and intentionally gave a false version of what he knew to be the case to the public protector. It bears a repetition that the president carefully and intentionally gave a false version of what he knew to be the case to the public protector. What he did is highly unethical and a resounding rejection or dereliction of his key constitutional obligations. This is therefore not a question of the president and his team mistakenly putting forward a version, such as he did in the National Assembly with regard to the alleged Busasa donation to his son, which he subsequently corrected. It is rather a case of a calculated misrepresentation of fact by someone who is confident that the truth would never be uncovered. He says, no wonder the president and his team have made no attempt at reconciling their own version with the emails. The two versions are mutually exclusive or destructive and obviously incapable of reconciliation. And all the president could do and did was to keep on asking the public protector, and I paraphrase, how did you manage to access this well-kept and closely guarded secret? Who gave you this painful, who gave this painful truth to you? That's the Chief Justice conclusion at the end of that summary, that all the president could do and did was to keep on asking the public protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, how did you manage to access this well-kept or closely guarded secret? Who gave this painful truth to you without being forthcoming with any version? Then the last question relates to this thing about whether she prescribes or refers. And then he says, and this is important, it appears that she acted in terms of Section 646, Roman 1 of the Public Protector Act to recommend to the police and the prosecuting authority to pursue possible charges of money laundering against the president. The subsection reads, and then he quotes the subsection. It says, the public protector shall be competent, see, at a time prior to or during or after an investigation, one, if he or she is of the opinion that the facts disclose the commission of an offense by any person, to bring the matter to the notice of the relevant authority charged with prosecution. That's the issue we covered earlier. She can prosecute herself, but she is obliged by law to refer that such criminality to the relevant authorities. Does that capture the section you were looking for that you were referring to earlier, Mr. Matabuha?
Yes, yeah, that is correct.
Then the Chief Justice says finally, and this is what she did in relation to the money laundering charge. I hasten to add that she was wrong to have been somewhat prescriptive by couching a referral to the offense in the form of a supervisory order. Hers was to refer, not to monitor or to infer and to enforce. So the public, rather even the Chief Justice criticized the public protector for some of the language. But he says this, if the public protector, quote, is of the opinion that facts disclose the commission of an offense, she is empowered to notify the prosecuting authority of what her, in her opinion, rightly or wrongly, constitutes the commission of an offense. Nothing in the in Section 641C1 limits her to the type of class or offenses that she is permitted to notify the NPA about. Even murder or robbery may be brought to their attention. The fact that she does not bear the primary responsibility to investigate criminal offenses or not expressly empowered to do so does not mean that she may not look into and subsequently refer to the relevant authority any offense that is intertwined with allegations of unethical conduct that she is otherwise entitled to investigate. Is that how you understood the obligations of the public protector in relation to criminality? And would you like to explain that referral power?
Yes, that is how I understand it. And as it were here, we're not being restrictive, except that when we do a remedial action, we have to have a monitoring of remedial action. Maybe that is why it sounded like it was now prescribed into the MPA on their reporting back on the possible charges that they have preferred.
Yes. Thank you. And then he says at 197, the allegation of money laundering and CR17 campaign are not divorced from the donation of the public that the public protector was asked to investigate. It is an integral part of that investigation. This is so because the source, the donation, is the same. They are virtually identical in nature and character. Honorable Maimane's concern, and we are intending to call Honorable Maimane well, he's no longer honorable now, to call Mr. Maimane to give the perspective of what it is that he was, but the committee yesterday had some views about it. But if eventually they allow him to come, he will put a perspective on of what was behind his complaint. Because isn't it important, Mr. Matabuge, always to remember that, sorry, I almost said you guys, but that the people at the public protector's office do not go around fishing for these things. Someone complains to you, and that's how you take it up.
Yes, and we always say we must improve the complaint when we investigate.
Sorry?
We always say you must be true to the complaint, meaning that was lodged with the
office. And then he then says, this is so, okay, Honorable Maimane's concern in this regard was about how the donated money moved through several intermediaries. It was therefore during and after the investigation of the donation to the CR17 campaign that she formed an opinion that the president might have committed money laundering. And this falls squarely within her Section 664C1 powers. Then regarding the issue of, this is an issue I raised with your colleague, Ms. Mvuyane. This is about how, what brings us here really, what the Chief Justice called the magnification of the public protector's errors. In other words, he understands that you and the public protector might have made errors, but he says that they get magnified. And he quotes the judgment that I was referring Justice Ms. Mvuyane to. He says, 198, the following wisdom-laden words of caution by Madlanga J encapsulate the concern I have about the treatment of matters involving the public protector. Advocate Busisiwe Nkwebane particularly have findings and recommendations or remedial steps. Although the context was different, the message or principle is just as apposite and telling in all other cases. There, Madlanga J said, and I quote, there appears to be a developing trend of seeking personal cost orders in most, if not all, matters involving the public protector. Courts must be wary not to fall into the trap of thinking that the public protector is fair game for automatic personal cost awards. Whether inadvertently or otherwise, the High Court judgments in the EFF Godan matter and in the instant matter are instances where the High Court fell into that trap. He says, I voice these words of caution because of the disturbing frequency and irregularity of application for and awards of personal costs against the public protector. What is particularly disturbing is that it is clear that the applications and awards are not always justified. Then he then says the Chief Justice, there is indeed a disturbing tendency by some of us to presumably without intending undue harm or injustice, unduly magnify virtually every error of the public protector, real or mistakenly perceived. This is quite surprising because judges with more experience as practitioners before their elevation to the bench and with more years of service as judges than the 10 years minimum requirement as an advocate or the mere fact of being a judge, regardless of how long to be appointable as a public protector, have committed similar or more serious errors. And we are not as harsh on them, or should I say on ourselves, and rightly so. And then in probably one of the most acts of self-effacing Christianity, which he is our chief, former Chief Justice, he makes an example against his own interest, where he was castigated, rightly so, by the Supreme Court of Appeal for having sat as a judge in a case where his wife was the prosecutor. And this is the kind of thing that he says he was never impeached for. He says, by way of example, I presided in a matter in which my wife was appearing on behalf of the state, and that was S versus Dube. The Supreme Court of Appeal correctly and most courteously held that I should have granted the recusal application necessitated by the very appearance of my wife before me. As an aside, in this committee, that kind of thing is not, if Justice McQueen was here, he would have been fine. And then it says, Haram J.A.'s son appeared before a Supreme Court of Appeal panel of which he, the father, was a member. And so did Charles Carlson P.'s son in this court. With the benefit of hindsight, I have realized that a reasonable apprehension of bias would most likely be entertained in matters of this kind. Each of us should therefore have recused himself without the need for an application to that effect. As judges, we should therefore always be alive to the reality that the elevation to the high judicial office does not have the inherent consequence of clothing any of us with a mantle of infallibility. For this reason, when we criticize others, we would do well to be alive to our own fallibility. But more examples are necessary to drive the point home. So what the Chief Justice was saying was, do unto others as you would like to be done to you, which most people should adhere to, he says. Now, this goes to a case that Ms. Mazzoni has presented to this committee for castigating the public protector. That is, you'll find that in the charge sheet chapterson, the addendum of Ms. Mazzoni, it's the case of Commissioner for Subsequent Revenue Services versus Public Protector, the High Court one. It's number 5.2. This is where probably the worst example where the judge basically insulted the public protector. Says the Chief Justice, without any basis in fact or law, Mabuse J concluded in Commissioner of South African Revenue Services versus the public protector that the public protector had a, quote, proclivity to operate out of the bounds of the law, and, quote, a deep-rooted recalcitrance to accepting advice from senior and junior counsel. And this was cited as proof of her unreasonable, arbitrary, and malafide conduct. He went on to order punitive costs against her in her personal capacity, a shocking and most unjust decision under the circumstances. Similarly, in Cabinde, this court held that two of its members had erred. But all this means is that the manner and extent to which judges and magistrates criticize litigants, legal practitioners, and witnesses should be a mirror image of the same measure of criticism they would find acceptable under comparable circumstances, were it to be meted out to them by their colleagues, the practitioners, or the public. We must therefore do to others as we would have them do, have others do to us. Then the last one, he says, that said, I'm also concerned about the notion that she somehow amended the code without authority. This is one of the charges here. I think hers was more of giving a wrong meaning to a legal instrument than amending it. But returning to the source of my concern, I cannot be correct to brand virtually everything she did in line with her constitutional and statutory duty to expose and help root out unethical conduct as shockingly wrong and worthy of strong criticism and outright rejecting. That, in my view, constitutes the magnification of her errors that courts should, as a way of distinguishing themselves from the media, commentators or analysts, the general public or the so-called court of public opinion, be deliberate and intentional about steering clear of. After all, that is what fidelity to our oath of office demands of us all the time. It bears repetition that all litigants, practitioners and witnesses deserve only the measure of criticism that we as judges and magistrates would be happy to be recipients of under similar circumstances. And that applies with equal force to the public protector. And then his conclusion is, I therefore support the main judgment only to the extent that it is reconcilable with these reasons. In sum, I uphold the appeal, make no orders to cost, and so on. That is the end. Do you remember those questions, Mr. Matabuko?
Yes, I do have remember them, yes.
Yes. So that judgment, before I let you go, in terms of the two approaches, to what extent, and I want you to say this in your own words, does this judgment then at least vindicate or reflect your true approach as opposed to the one that says that you were out to get Mr. Ramaphosa? And the real question I wanted to answer before you go is, how does it make you feel to be accused of the opposite to what the Chief Justice says you were doing?
It was disappointing, because I need to take a step back and go back to the time the judgment was announced, because as part of the internal process, whenever judgments are given, our legal services meet with the investigators and take us through the basis for the review and the judgment that was passed. So when the High Court judgment was passed, we kept on going to the conference to discuss the judgment. And part of my take when I was asked to respond was that I can't wait for the day the Constitutional Court passes or puts a weight to the investigation. Then after the Constitutional Court judgment, I then feel, even if it would be to the negative, I'd only accept what the Constitutional Court would have ruled on the investigation. As part of the investigators, we're all in the conference when I said, until the outcome is there by the Constitutional Court, I'll still stick by the report. And when this judgment came out and the minority judgment was read out, I still said to the team and the colleagues to say, at least there's one voice of reason for us as investigators, one thing that has come back to help me up and put back myself as a chief investigator. And that is how even today I still stick by the fact that not all that was done by me and the team and the people in this investigation was lost to a because at least somebody saw what we did as not being as bad. Had it not been maybe for this man or that man, I'd be very, very much, you know, I don't know if I may use the word despondent and very discouraged as an investigator.
Yes. No, thank you. God bless Mahwen CJ. And were you ever, as part of this alleged conspiracy and vendetta against Mr. Ramaphosa, alleged and in brackets non-existent, were you ever charged at the institution where you are now? Did you ever face any disciplinary action, or is it just the public protector who's supposed to be the only member of that conspiracy who must be removed from her office? In other words, or maybe let me put it this way. If it was a genuine concern to assist the public, if it was not a witch hunt against a defenseless black woman to get rid of the public protector for ulterior purposes by powerful forces, would it make any difference to just remove her from office and leave the likes of you and Ms. Mbiana and the others who are allegedly part of this nefarious conspiracy untouched if you were not charged? If you get what I'm saying, maybe the first question, were you ever charged or accused of any wrongdoing?
No, I was never charged, but the atmosphere in the office when this thing happened, as an investigator, you get to be looked down upon by your colleagues, and as if you've misled and you become a bit of a leprous in the office.
Yeah.
But I was never charged.
Thank you. And in your social life, for people who know that you are involved in such a high profile and important job for the country, how does it make you feel when you then get lambasted as some vendetta-driven conspirator?
No, it affects your image and your profile in the public space, especially when one comes from a background of a university and where we had colleagues that are also practicing, some are in high positions. It impacts on your person somehow negatively.
Thank you. So from the hateful, cruel, bigotist and prejudiced people who want to hold to get rid of the public protector, do you think that anyone cares about quote unquote collateral damage to that mission, such as yourself and the other people who then get socially castigated and hurt in the manner that you have expressed?
Maybe if they had a chance, they would come for us as well, I think.
I agree. Thank you very much, Chaperson. As they say, one day they come for the communists, one day they come for these ones, and I keep quiet. And lastly, one day they will come for me. So I hope they never come for you, Mr. Matabuche, but I think you have the sympathies of the majority of South Africans and right-thinking persons. At least you have the sympathies of and the rational support of the Chief Justice of this country. Thank you, Chaperson.
Thank you. On that note of the former Chief Justice, we are going to pause for the day.
I still call him the future.
The meeting will be adjourned and we'll meet tomorrow at 9. Thank you, meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Chaperson.